Shall I continue?
Yeah.
I think just to finish that, there was clearly a need for a consistent, maybe stick-and-carrot type approach with the Khmer Rouge to try and engage them in the process. Because as I said, once they pulled back and didn't disarm, there was no way to disarm Sok. They had every justification to remain at least partially, as they did.
Right.
And that was really an impasse which we never overcame. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also reflected in the current situation in Cambodia today.
You mentioned the donor countries. I wondered, were you sensitive to any influence by the donor countries or by, for that matter, the five permanent members of the Security Council in the operations in Cambodia?
Oh yes, we met with them regularly, and the EP5, Expanded Permanent 5, mm-hmm. 5 plus 4, I think, Germany, Japan, Australia, Indonesia, from memory, were very crucial in the process. They came to the Supreme National Council meetings with UNTAG, with Sihanouk and the faction leaders. They consulted constantly, and we went to them on issues. I certainly did on human rights as well. Separately or collectively, but usually separately. Without the backing of some of those members, we couldn't have done the human rights actions that we took.
Yeah, and well, actually, it was Akashi who indicated that they reported back more or less to their principals in New York and prepared the way. So there was not, you didn't perceive differences between New York, between the Security Council, and what was being done in the field.
I think that worked, it seemed to me at least, it worked rather well. To have that formal setup of an expanded Security Council group really monitoring on an almost daily basis out there and, as you say, feeding back, I think that by and large worked. And I think from what we saw, the members of that group also put pressure on their favorite faction, as it were, as necessary. No, I think that was generally quite a useful mechanism.
I want to go now to the general area of what's called peace building. And your staff was perhaps in the best position to observe the degree of reconciliation that was taking place, if any, within the society. What are your comments on that?
There was very little reconciliation in the Cambodian society, I think, during our period that we were there. Very few tangible signs of it. On the contrary, mm-hmm. I think the Supreme National Council was held together by the wily chairmanship of Prince Sihanouk. Without him, frankly, I doubt that the factions would even have sat around the table, and even with him, it was often very acrimonious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, don't forget, not only had the Khmer Rouge pulled out, but Hun Sen's people were physically attacking Ranarit's people, Funsimpek, on a regular basis, and KPLF Son San's people as well, and the divisions and the hostility between the factions was overwhelmingly apparent in all aspects. I don't honestly recall any overt reconciliation processes, frankly.
Even at the lower level, in the field, among the peoples?
Well, as always, I think, you know, the further you go down, the people tend to live and coexist together. I think that's true, yes. But it's a very fractionalized and distrustful society. It was, and I believe still is, obviously partly through the traumatic history that they've had. And that reflected even amongst the NGOs. They tended to have alliances or linkages or factional loyalties which made them very distrustful and as I mentioned earlier, unwilling to often to work together. So I think that remained a major uncovered area which still needs to be addressed probably.
What did you think then was the most important function that the UNTAC or the UN could play in strengthening its democratic institutions in Cambodia?
Well, I think, you know, having an election obviously has a value, but the trouble was that it became an end in itself. As now again, I see it's likely to become for the second time in Cambodia, with the EU funding the new election of Mr. Hun Sen. You know, it was done without anything like equal attention to the other fundamental aspects of civil society. There were 11 or 13 qualified lawyers in the entire country. The judges were not qualified or paid. The police were corrupt, militarized. The military were politically controlled, etc., etc. So accountability, as I said earlier, didn't exist for atrocities and killings and violations on a regular basis. So I think to have an election is fine, and it was a process which was an awareness building process. 90% of the population voted, and they voted for Mr. Ranarit, but you know, there were no institutions to prop it up. So Mr. Ranarit didn't take over. Mr. Hun Sen refused to let go. He then intimidated the operation, threatened the press, threatened members of parliament, and finally killed Mr. Ranarit's followers, threw him out, and is now going to have another election to endorse his position. So the basic, you know, necessary safeguards parallel to election were not in place. Were not in place, and if I may add there, were partly not in place because of the time factor, but also because UNTAG and its leadership and the donors and the Secretary General wanted to have an election and then get out. The message was very clear, have the election and get out. Even some of the Paris Accord mandated responsibilities, drafting the constitution, for example, which we started on, we were told, leave it, it's their business. We didn't follow up on the various safeguards that should have been put in the laws to try and preserve this very vulnerable, nervous, fledgling elected parliament. The message was go, and Prince Sihanouk locally led that call. He branded us the UNTACists, and the UNTACists should leave the country to the Cambodians, and I'm afraid that the donors and the UN by and large went along with that.
Does that reflect a real concern, not just on Sihanouk's part, but others, of the infringement of Cambodian sovereignty? Did you have a sense that you were infringing Cambodian sovereignty?
Oh, I think in collateral sense we infringed it mightily, but I think the Paris Peace Agreement was a massive infringement of sovereignty. It was a trusteeship de facto with Mr. Akashi with the powers of a governor general, and the UNTAG components really the de facto cabinet, if you like, or ministries of the country. So if that was the real concern, infringement of sovereignty, then the Paris Accord shouldn't have been signed. I think it's a very useful call, of course, after these overpaid UN officials are there in their thousands with their white vehicles, that, you know, we've got to reassert our independence. The fact is the country was not willing or able to take on those responsibilities as were foreseen in the Paris Agreements themselves.
You mentioned there a neuralgic point. Was there much resentment, not just between the UN people and the Cambodians, but also the UN people and the NGOs, as to the difference in pay?
Well, there always is. And of course, if you flood into an impoverished, traumatized society like Cambodia with 20,000 UN officials or peacekeepers and 8,000 vehicles, the radios, etc., then you're going to have that reaction. And that, I think, is natural and understandable. It's also easy to exploit. But certainly there's a hostility, both, I would say, probably more by the international NGOs rather than the local ones, many of whom we worked very closely with. That's a traditional shot, which is unavoidable, I guess. At the same time, there should have been and could have been more sensitivity by the UN and by all of our components. We eventually had to have a special liaison officer set up. In fact, she worked in my office to receive complaints from Cambodians against UNTAG personnel. And one of our recommendations and our lessons from this is that such operations, if they should ever happen again, should in fact automatically have an ombudsperson type function in them to deal with the local reactions, because there will be local reactions.
Also against the military, right?
Military, police, and UNTAG personnel in general, ranging from, you know, landlord-tenant disputes to abuse of the women by UNTAG military, police, and other officials. Yeah.
The word genocide is not used in the Paris Agreements, and there was no effort made to establish a truth commission or a committee in Cambodia. What is your reaction to that? What do you think about that? What was your feeling about that while you were there?
Well, I think technically in international law terms, killing your own people as the Khmer Rouge did is not genocide,
mm-hmm.
because it's not with the intention to eliminate an ethnic or mm-hmm. comparable group. So technically that's probably right. It's a massive atrocity, call it whatever. But I think there is an argument that genocide is not the appropriate term. There was an attempt to use auto-genocide, but that was also, I think, it doesn't really have any formal meaning. But genocide has a treaty meaning, of course, as you know.
Very much so, yeah.
So I think that's why there was a resistance, apart from the political concerns.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the Paris Accords, from where we talked about the non-repeating of the actions of the past, wasn't it?
Yes, which are described as regrettable and...
some sort of soft, new, which is also an insult to the victims.
Unacceptable.
Unacceptable insult to the victims. I think, you know, there was a glossing over of that. Clearly, to have the Paris Accord signed, that was glossed. And the result was that none of us had any authority to look at it. What is interesting to me, though, is that setting up a human rights component, as we did, I don't think that we had any or virtually any complaints about the atrocities of the Khmer Rouge, which
really?
Is very interesting.
Mm.
The first 100 complaints we got and finally couldn't handle anymore were property complaints, land complaints, neighbors, fence, ownership complaints. The property issue was a major issue, and of course it's Khmer Rouge linked because most of Cambodians have been displaced and they were trying to get their properties back. But I don't think we had any, I have to be corrected here, I'm not aware of any formal complaint to the human rights component against the Khmer Rouge for atrocities. There's almost a mass sort of pseudo-amnesia, glossing over. If it comes up, it's almost lightheartedly, which seems to me to be very unhealthy. There's been no catharsis in the Cambodian society.
Well, that's why I asked the question of a truth commission or something
yes.
like that.
Yes.
You would have thought that might have been useful.
I think it's absolutely essential to have a process
mm-hmm.
to get rid of the terrible trauma, or not get rid of it, but to reduce the effects of it long term in any society,
mm-hmm.
whether it's Rwanda or South Africa or Cambodia. Absolutely essential. And I'm afraid if you don't deal with it, it comes out and it's a bit like individuals, you know, if you don't deal with complex problems, they come out in some other unexpected way. And I think that's a bit what's happened in Cambodia still.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very destabilized society, which has never had an opportunity to have an outlet on these issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and one of the recommendations that we certainly made from the human rights point of view was that any human rights component in these situations should have an authority for past atrocities. Now, that's easier said than done, but we certainly believe that a process is necessary.
Now, you were mentioning the prisons earlier, and I judge that you did inspect some of them.
Sorry, okay.
Mm-hmm. Who arranged for the release of some political prisoners who were in the prisons?
Prison inspection was a major part of our monitoring activities. Prison
right.
access, trying to get access to all the prisons systematically throughout the country. Getting prisoners out of dark holes, getting shackles removed, dealing with malnutrition, they were atrocious, and they are, again, I think, atrocious conditions in those prisons. Major task which we couldn't complete. The release, some of it was done by the authorities linked to the peace accords, but we also persuaded Prince Sihanouk to issue an amnesty for untried prisoners. 90%, I forget the exact figure now, of prisoners in Cambodia have never been tried and probably will never be tried. The system has collapsed and they were literally rotting in those jails. So we did get him to, I think on his birthday, to announce releases of prisoners who hadn't been tried for a certain period, whether they were political or otherwise. The backlash on that was we were then accused of having increased the crime rate by emptying the criminals into the society, but it was the only way we could see of trying reducing that terrible population.
A quick question. There were two American organizations, the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute, which were active in promoting democratization or strengthening institutions. How did you observe their activities?
From a distance. They came and saw us, as I recall, when they came to town. They rather operated in something of a different world than us. I think there was some risk that they were transplanted, well-intentioned but transplanted initiatives, as far as we saw them, and certainly didn't try and link up with the sort of grassroots efforts that we had been making. They may well have had a positive effect at other levels, but I certainly didn't see them working into the sort of human rights areas that we had been focusing on.
Now, you were dependent, certainly for any arrests, even if a few were made, to a certain extent on CIVPOL.
Mm-hmm.
What are your comments on CIVPOL? How did that function? What that is?
The bank didn't pay that, too.
Yeah.
You want to stop it for there? Should we continue?
Yeah.
The first comment...
I think we better stop.
I think we better. I'll ask them if they can stop for a second.
There.
Excuse me. We're just finishing interview taping. Is it possible to hold that for a few minutes?
Okay, yes.
We agreed to use it just for five. Thank you.
Oh, that's good, because we're almost...
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah.
I know you have to go.
That's all right. No, five's all right. I guess the first experience with CIVPOL was, as you say, absolutely essential for us. CIVPOL, I'd say, more than the military in many respects, the investigation, the backup, the logistics, all of that, crucial for any human rights. And I'd say in general, in passing, CIVPOL has unexplored potential in peacekeeping in general, in my humble opinion. But I think the first experience was that CIVPOL needed to be trained and briefed. And we tried crash human rights briefing training of all CIVPOL as they arrived, but we overwhelmed our small component. We did it for the first arrivals. We couldn't do it for everyone, but many of them didn't have any of the basic elements of what human rights operations were about either. So we essentially had to concentrate on working with the senior officers down, the key senior people who were experienced, had been in other operations, so that we could get their collaboration. But I think one of the lessons out of that is also the need to have a basic training, and as you mentioned, I think standing operating procedures should include the basic elements of the human rights dimension if we're going to work together in these sorts of operations.
You really, what you're suggesting is that we need to develop a standard, an SOP, which had not been developed.
No. And we tried to develop it, and we did get cooperation from the senior level of CIVPOL, but it was too little too late, really. We were already on the ground, and we had no time to develop it properly.
I think you've already indicated the answer to this, but how would you assess the lasting effect in Cambodia of the human rights efforts, but also of the other efforts made for peace building in that society by the United Nations?
I guess one of my greatest frustrations, which again we've tried to put into the lessons learned process, is the lack of willingness of many parties to invest in the longer term peace building civil society aspects. If you go into those operations with huge resources for a very short period to have an election, it's absolutely essential that the election is not the end in itself, as I mentioned earlier. And I think a great frustration for many of us was the total lack of willingness to address those wider issues on a long-term basis, because these are not short-term, quick-fix issues. You have to rebuild judiciaries. You have to retrain police out of those situations. You have to hold military accountable for killing of civilians. You can't allow journalists to be killed or prisoners or parliamentarians to be assassinated or locked up, etc., etc. And that's a whole complex equation of measures which have to be worked. And I'm afraid there's just an international impatience which doesn't lend itself to that. As I said before, the elections have a value, but there's this awful over-enthusiasm for an election at all costs and being the answer to all things, which it clearly is not. And I think that would be the great frustration shared by many of my colleagues in this area, that you have to build institutions as you monitor. You have to take lessons out of the monitoring of the violations and put them into the institution building. The police officials have to be persuaded that it's not in their long-term interest to beat and arbitrarily detain and not try. The judges have to be persuaded it's not in their long-term interest to follow their political directions, etc., etc.
Let me just ask at the end here, is there anything out of your experience that you would like to put on the record here as of interest and value to historians and to others who are going to be looking at Cambodia for a long time to come?
That's a big question. I suppose my frustration is now being back with UNHCR and going the last few months back to the Cambodian border and seeing 60,000 new refugees from Cambodia, and then going into Phnom Penh and finding that those people have left for the same sort of reasons that the people left when we went into peacekeeping. And we've come this terrible circle. And as I said earlier, that now the international community wants to fund another election to sanctify what has happened and to get on with the business of trade and aid and business. And I suppose in that sense Cambodia is perhaps one of the more obvious examples of a flawed international effort to try and rebuild and restabilize a terribly destabilized and destroyed society. And I must say, when I look at Rwanda, for example, where I've been working a lot on recently, a lot of the same approaches are obvious. There just doesn't seem to be the awareness, willingness, commitment, whatever it is, political will in the broad sense, to invest in those processes. And that, I guess, is a great frustration, because it seems to me very short-sighted. You're going to have a new refugee exodus. You're going to have another collapsed state. You're going to have another military dictatorship. Maybe you're going to have business and some profits as well, but in the process, all of those things that these peacekeeping operations such as Cambodia were designed around, the principles of justice and humanity and peace and stability, are not there. Trying to build those sort of things on a quicksand base, as it were, not being willing to invest in the foundations, seems to me terribly short-sighted. But we're a bit of a broken record on this, I guess, especially from the refugee perspective, because we see the consequences of that again and again and again.
But from your experience, do you think that this process, which really is democratization, can be brought about by external forces?
Not alone. And it may not need 20,000 peacekeepers to do it either.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, we're talking about ideal worlds, but I think a sensitive, sustained, and clearly planned commitment by the international community,
mm-hmm.
which means the country concerned, its neighbors, and the broader donor community,
mm-hmm.
can do a lot, but it has to be a tandem process. It has to be incentives and pressures, linkages, graduated maybe, but I think, yes, if there was that willingness to do that, certainly in the transitions from, you know, post-conflict, there is a potential there. It can't be done always alone, I think that's clear.
Mm-hmm.
Cambodians of this world can't get on their feet alone, except in a negative way, perhaps. It can't be imposed either, but I think there is a subtle balancing of interests and efforts that can have an effect, but they've got to be sustained. I guess the bottom line is sustain it, stay with it. If you do it in the short term, quick fix, it's not going to hold, I'm afraid.
And just in that connection, do you see the need for a clearer definition of the relationship and the respective roles of NGOs and the United Nations in situations such as Cambodia? Well, I'm speaking now primarily of external NGOs.
External NGOs?
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's an inevitable tension. On the other hand, we can't live without them either.
Yeah.
Maybe they can't live without us, I'm not sure. But we're unavoidable partners with misconceptions on both sides. I think as UNHCR, we have 400 NGOs who implement most of our programs.
Mm-hmm.
So they're absolutely an essential part of it. I think they also, many of the international ones, need to learn the lessons that the UN needs to learn, which is to build local capacities. They're not necessarily very good at that either. International NGOs don't necessarily build indigenous NGOs very strongly. Neither does the UN and the peacekeeping effort. And I think there should be a joint awareness that this is a crucial part of it. But yes, I think they're essential partners. I don't think they're the answer for everything, but neither is the UN. I think we have complementary roles to play. And I think there is a need for a greater, a renewed alliance, perhaps, and understanding, as we've tried in UNHCR, which is a reach-out operation to NGOs in all regions, to try and agree on the ground rules and how we can collaborate, yes.
Which I judge has been relatively successful.
Relatively successful, I think. We have an agreed framework for action.
Mm-hmm.
We have formal agreements and informal agreements, but, you know, the process is an ongoing one. And I've just met with the heads of the 6 major humanitarian NGOs in Geneva recently on protection of refugee issues and asked that they also sort of keep these issues on their humanitarian relief agendas, Oxfam and Save the Children and so on, that they don't just talk about the relief, but they also talk about the criminals in the camps or the vulnerable women and children sort of thing. I think those sort of alliances need more and more to be formed when we're facing these problems with states that we're facing.
Thank you very much. I know that your time is about up.
Mm-hmm.
And those actually were the major questions.
Okay.
But if you have other...